In the rugged mountains of Kurdistan, I witnessed firsthand how geography shaped human destiny. While Saddam Hussein's regime controlled Iraq's flat terrain with an iron grip, his power diminished in the northern mountains where Kurdish resistance flourished. This pattern repeats across history and continents, from the Carpathians marking Europe's cultural transitions to Central Asia's harsh steppes that have channeled invasions for millennia. Even seemingly permanent political boundaries like the Berlin Wall prove temporary compared to mountain ranges and river systems that have shaped civilizations for thousands of years. As political upheavals continue to reshape our world, from the Arab Spring to Ukraine's ongoing struggles, understanding geography offers a crucial lens for making sense of it all. Robert Kaplan's masterful exploration of this subject has become required reading in military academies and foreign policy circles worldwide, offering a perspective that transcends the digital age's illusion of a borderless world to reveal how the physical map still dictates the contours of power, conflict, and human possibility. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 marked a profound moment when we lost our geographical sense. Rather than enhancing respect for natural boundaries, this artificial borders removal blinded us to real geographical impediments still dividing humanity. The decade that followed saw Western intellectuals champion human agency over geographical determinism, with Central Europe becoming their model, not a geographical fact, but an idea representing cobblestone streets, Viennese cafes, and humanist traditions. This romantic vision obscured the deep ethnic, religious, and territorial divisions that would soon resurface across Eastern Europe and the Balkans. The post-Cold War era ushered in what Francis Fukuyama famously called the end of history, where liberal democracy seemed destined to triumph globally. This idealistic vision united liberal internationalists and neoconservatives in the 1990s, propelling humanitarian interventionism from Bosnia to Kosovo and ultimately to Baghdad. The military successes in the Balkans, particularly NATO's 78-day air campaign against Serbia in 1999, created a dangerous illusion that modern warfare could overcome geographical constraints through air power. With minimal American casualties, these interventions temporarily defeated the Vietnam analogy and made military force synonymous with humanitarianism. The Munich analogy, referring to the appeasement of Hitler in 1938, became the dominant framework for foreign policy thinking. Influential intellectuals like Leon Wieseltier argued that a war against genocide must be fought with fury, while dismissing practical concerns about exit strategies and long-term stabilization. This interventionist triumphalism reached its apex after 9/11, when the same mindset led to catastrophic overreach in Iraq. Here, geography would reassert itself with particular force in the form of vast deserts, urban warfare in ancient cities, and the artificial colonial borders that trapped opposing ethnic and religious groups together. The author witnessed this reality firsthand while embedded with Marines in Iraq in 2004, observing the complex logistics required to move troops just several hundred kilometers across hostile desert terrain. Simple geographic realities, the need for secure supply lines, the vulnerability of forces in open terrain, the challenge of urban combat in ancient cities like Fallujah, demonstrated how geography shapes military operations. The Iraq War brought Americans back to geographical realism, accepting the severe constraints geography imposes in places like Mesopotamia and Afghanistan, where mountains, deserts, and tribal territories have frustrated empires for millennia. Yet understanding these limitations offers hope. By becoming expert map readers, we can, aided by technology like precision munitions and satellite reconnaissance, stretch some geographical constraints while respecting others that cannot be overcome. Modern military technology can mitigate some geographic challenges, but cannot eliminate them entirely. The rise of China, Russia's territorial ambitions, and ongoing conflicts in the Middle East all demonstrate how geography continues to shape international relations and strategic thinking. Geography informs rather than determines. It's not fatalism, but a major constraint on and instigator of state actions. As Yale strategist Nicholas Spikeman noted, geography does not argue, it simply is. This reality check on post-Cold War idealism suggests that successful foreign policy must work with, rather than against, geographic realities.
The geographical limitations of empires throughout history reveal how landscape interacts with political structure to shape imperial reach. The Ottoman centralized military system, requiring the emperor's presence and operating from Constantinople, restricted their campaigns to single-season marches. Vienna to the northwest and Mosul to the southeast marked their stable expansion limits. Similar patterns emerge with the Roman Empire, which struggled to maintain control beyond natural barriers like the Rhine and Danube rivers, and the Persian Empire, whose attempts to expand beyond the Bosporus repeatedly failed. This pattern echoes across civilizations, focusing our attention on what scholars call the Oikoumene, that crucial region between the Eastern Mediterranean and Iranian-Afghan plateau where Eurasian and African landmasses converge. This ultra-strategic area, with outlets to the Indian Ocean via the Red Sea and Persian Gulf, remains the focus of today's headlines just as it was the setting for Herodotus's histories 2,500 years ago. The region's importance stems from its role as a crossroads of trade routes, cultural exchange, and military campaigns, from the Silk Road to modern oil transportation routes. Herodotus exemplifies the balanced approach to geography we need today, showing how landscape forms the backdrop against which human passions and decisions play out. His writings preserve the memory of diverse civilizations and their landscapes, from Egyptians who shaved eyebrows when mourning cats to the Massagete who feasted on their elderly. He documents the Scythians' nomadic lifestyle adapted to the steppes, the Phoenicians' mastery of Mediterranean sea routes, and the Egyptians' intimate relationship with the Nile's annual flood cycle. He demonstrates how ancient peoples experienced geography more vividly than we do, seeing gods like Pan in the sparsely settled landscapes where nature was not yet eclipsed by man. While geography creates enduring patterns, like the millennia of conflict between peoples of Asia and Greece, Herodotus also reveals how human agency operates within these constraints. The Persian invasion of Greece begins not just from geographical proximity, but from bedroom politics, when Queen Atossa manipulates King Darius's vanity. He shows how Themistocles used knowledge of local winds and currents to defeat the Persian fleet at Salamis, and how Leonidas chose the narrow pass at Thermopylae to neutralize Persian numerical superiority. This balance between geographical determinism and human agency prepares us to engage with the more deterministic geopolitical theories that followed, frameworks that make liberal humanists uneasy but provide essential insights into global power dynamics. Modern examples continue to demonstrate this interplay. Russia's persistent search for warm water ports, China's Belt and Road Initiative following ancient trade routes, and ongoing conflicts in the Persian Gulf region all echo patterns Herodotus first documented. His work remains relevant as we grapple with how geography shapes but does not dictate human affairs in an age of global interconnection and technological advancement. Times of global upheaval revitalize geographical thinking as they challenge assumptions about political maps' permanence. The British geographer Sir Halford Mackinder developed his influential heartland theory during such a period, arguing that whoever controlled Eastern Europe would command the heartland of Eurasia and potentially rule the world. Mackinder's proposal for buffer states between Germany and Russia proved prophetic yet flawed. While his vision of independent Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Dagestan closely matched what emerged after the Soviet collapse in 1991, he failed to recognize that a Europe organized by national self-determination would inevitably be dominated by Germany. Germany conquered Eastern Europe in the 1930s-40s, followed by Russia imprisoning these buffer nations from 1945-1989. His prediction that the Soviet Union would emerge as the greatest land power on the globe came true after both world wars.
The Soviets' quest for warm water ports led to their disastrous Afghanistan invasion, and Russia's current attempts to reconsolidate Belarus, Ukraine, the Caucasus, and Central Asia represents one of our era's principal geopolitical dramas, validating Mackinder's insights a century later. American strategist Nicholas Spykman challenged Mackinder's emphasis on the heartland with his Rimland thesis. While Mackinder focused on continental power, Spykman argued that the maritime-oriented Rimland, Europe, South Asia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan, and the oil-rich Middle East, was key to world power. This Rimland thesis would later influence Cold War containment policy against Soviet expansion. Meanwhile, American naval theorist Alfred Thayer Mahan championed sea power as more important and less threatening to international stability than land power. Mahan argued that navies' limited ability to extend force inland made them no threat to liberty, and that the Indian and Pacific Oceans, not Eurasia's heartland, were the true hinges of geopolitical destiny. These competing frameworks still shape our understanding of Eurasia's power dynamics, even as technology transforms the strategic landscape. As geography loses its battle against military and technological advances, a crisis of room emerges across Eurasia. The continent's finite size becomes a force for instability as missile ranges expand, populations grow, and military capabilities increase. While Americans and Europeans focus on globalization, nationalism and military power flourish throughout Asia, with an unbroken belt of countries from Israel to North Korea developing nuclear or chemical arsenals and ballistic missiles. This creates a multipolar balance of terror across a 6,000-mile arc, collapsing regional distinctions into a single organic military space where the death of distance prevails. Disruptive technologies, computer viruses, and weapons of mass destruction undermine leadership and destabilize the global power structure by changing the game and upsetting existing advantages. 25 cities worldwide now have populations exceeding 10 million, with this number projected to reach 40 by 2015, almost all in the developing world. For the first time in history, urbanization operates on a global scale as rural dwellers migrate to cities across Eurasia, Africa, and South America. These vast conurbations break into self-governing neighborhoods influenced by ideologies transmitted through electronic communications. Eurasia and North Africa's urban concentrations, overlapping missile ranges, and global media create constantly enraged crowds fed by rumors and truths transmitted instantly between third world cities. Social media empowers these crowds, large groups abandoning individuality for collective symbols. As Elias Canetti observed in Crowds and Power, we yearn to be inside crowds for shelter from danger and loneliness. Our era presents grave contradictions. Some states grow militarily stronger with weapons of mass destruction, while others weaken, spawning terrain-specific sub-state armies like Hezbollah, Taliban, and Iraqi militias. Even as precision-guided missiles can target specific buildings from hundreds of miles away, turbaned irregulars exploit mountain landscapes to bedevil superpowers. As states become fragile despite being well-armed, smaller regions will emerge in bolder lines, similar to the Middle Ages after Rome's fall. Yet, in Mackinder's now fully closed political system, entropy will eventually create equilibrium, with each human habitation increasingly resembling others and subject to similar passions, producing what Randall Schweller calls global ennui mixed with individual extremism and dogmatic posturing by states. Contemporary geopolitics often neglects Europe in favor of Afro-Asia, reducing it to mere financial stories. This is a profound miscalculation. With 500 million people and a 16 trillion economy, Europe occupies a pivotal global position, facing North America from its west, overlooking Afro-Eurasia from its east, and sitting equidistant between the Russian Far East and South Africa. This strategic location has historically made Europe both a crossroads of global trade and a crucial player in international relations. Europe's remarkable coastline, 23,000 miles long, multiple seas, including the Mediterranean, Baltic, and North Sea, extensive river valleys, Rhine, Danube, Loire, and mountain masses, Alps, Carpathians, Pyrenees, have fostered separate language groups and nation-states that will continue contributing to political disunity despite EU institutions. These geographic features created natural barriers that isolated populations, leading to distinct cultural and linguistic development. For instance, the Alps helped preserve Italian distinctiveness from Germanic influences, while the Pyrenees created a natural boundary between France and Spain. Though European civilization first flowered along the Mediterranean in Greece and Rome, benefiting from mild climate and navigable seas, it continued developing northward in colder regions during ages of advanced technology. Northern Europe's rich forest soils, extensive river access, and abundant mineral deposits enabled the Protestant Reformation and Enlightenment to flourish there. Cities like Amsterdam, London, and Hamburg became powerful centers of trade and intellectual development. The mineral-rich Carolingian core, encompassing modern-day France, Germany, and the Benelux countries, has now succeeded in the form of the European Union, demonstrating geography's decisive influence on Europe's development patterns. Europe's divisions extend beyond north-south to include profound east-west splits, shaped by migration routes along the Danube Valley that stretch from Hungary through the steppes to Mongolia. These routes facilitated both trade and invasion, bringing successive waves of peoples from the east. The Roman Empire's 4th-century split into western and eastern halves established enduring boundaries, with Rome's Western Empire evolving into Charlemagne's kingdom and Western Europe, while the Eastern Byzantine Empire, later conquered by Ottoman Turks migrating from the east, created a fundamentally different cultural zone. This division is still visible today in religious patterns, architectural styles, and political orientations. When the Warsaw Pact collapsed in 1989, former captive nations advanced economically and politically almost precisely according to their geographic positions. Poland, the Baltic states, Hungary, and Bohemia performed best due to their proximity to Western Europe and access to sea routes, while Balkan countries suffered destitution and unrest, partly due to their mountainous terrain and position at the crossroads of competing powers. Despite the 20th century's upheavals, the legacies of Prussian efficiency, Habsburg bureaucracy, Byzantine orthodoxy, and Ottoman influence remain relevant in modern governance structures, cultural practices, and social organizations across different regions of Europe. These geographic determinants continue to shape contemporary European politics, from Brexit negotiations to debates over EU expansion, demonstrating that while political boundaries may change, the fundamental influence of geography on human organization remains constant. Russia represents the world's preeminent land power, extending 170 degrees of longitude with its principal sea outlet blocked by Arctic ice much of the year. This geographical reality creates perennial insecurity, as Mahan noted. Without seas to protect them, land powers must constantly expand or risk conquest. Russia's flat expanse lacks natural borders, compelling it to push into Central and Eastern Europe against threats from France and Germany, toward Afghanistan against British India, into the Far East against China, and into the Caucasus as a barrier against Middle Eastern instability. Russia's severe climate, with most of its territory north of the 50th parallel, has profoundly shaped its national character, fostering a capacity for suffering, communalism, and willingness to sacrifice individuals for common good. The short growing season required interdependence among farmers and contributed to authoritarian tendencies, as elites needed to control wide areas with limited agricultural surpluses. Unlike other empires that collapse and disappear, Russia has expanded, collapsed, and revived several times due to its geographic position. Its first great empire, Kievan Rus, emerged in the 9th century at the intersection of Viking and Byzantine influences, but was destroyed by Mongols in the 13th century.
This drove Russian power northward to cities like Moscow, which rose to prominence due to its advantageous position at the hub of river routes. Russia's expansion is explained by Eurasia's relief map. From the Carpathians to the Central Siberian Plateau stretches nothing but lowland plains, with only the Urals as a minor interruption. This vast plain extends from the Arctic to the Caucasus and Hindu Kush Mountains, tempting Russian imperialism toward a warm water outlet on the Indian Ocean. Russia's vast territory, covering over a third of mainland Asia, with borders spanning half the world's time zones, had to be defended by a population only half that of the former Soviet Union, smaller even than Bangladesh. This created unprecedented peacetime vulnerability, with just 27 million people in all of Siberia and the Far East. Geography alone cannot sustain Russian power without unifying ideals. Russia's population of 141 million may drop to 111 million by 2050 due to low birth rates, high death rates, abortion, and minimal immigration, compounded by environmental degradation. Meanwhile, Russia's Muslim community is growing and may reach 20% within a decade, with Chechen women having over a third more children than ethnic Russians. China occupies a uniquely advantageous position, a continental-sized power with extensive oceanic access. Unlike America's neat sequence of forest, prairie, desert, mountain, and coast crossed by north-south rivers, China's great rivers, the Wei, Han, Yellow, and Yangtze, flow west to east, connecting the dry Eurasian interior to fertile coastal lands. China's core identity emerged from the contrast between its settled agricultural civilization and surrounding pastoral nomads of Inner Asia. The Great Wall reinforced this ecological and political distinction between the arable central plain, Zhongyuan, and the pastoral frontiers, Bianzhan. Unlike heavily militarized Russia, China developed a reasoned pacifism under Confucian doctrine, though it still experienced cycles of expansion into grasslands and invasions by pastoral nomads. China's current geopolitical position reflects both triumph and trauma. While at the peak of its continental power, controlling peripheral regions like Tibet, Xinjiang, and Inner Mongolia, China still carries the wounds of 19th-century territorial losses to European powers, Russia, and Japan. Unlike Russia, contemporary China extends influence through commerce rather than coercion. China's internal dynamism creates external ambitions, similar to how America's post-Civil War economic growth led to overseas expansion. However, China lacks America's missionary approach to world affairs, instead being driven abroad by the need to secure resources for its population, currently feeding 23% of humanity from just 7% of the world's arable land. China's advantageous position in Central East Asia is undermined by several geographical vulnerabilities. Mongolia represents a bitten away territory that China covets for its vast mineral resources. The Russian Far East presents another frontier of opportunity and tension. This vast region, twice the size of Europe, but with a dwindling population of just 6.7 million, borders Manchuria's 100 million Chinese. China's unprecedented land security has freed Beijing to pursue maritime power for the first time in centuries. Unlike coastal city-states naturally oriented toward the sea, continental China historically viewed naval power as a luxury. Now, with secure land borders, China can finally project power into the Pacific and potentially the Indian Ocean. East Asia now pits Chinese land power against American sea power, with Taiwan and the Korean Peninsula as focal points. China's favorable land position has enabled it to become a sea power as well, the major strategic shift in the region. Rather than adopting the benevolent approach of traditional maritime powers like Venice, Britain, or America, China thinks territorially about the sea, like an insecure land power expanding in concentric circles. Fernand Braudel, the preeminent historian of the Annales school, revolutionized historical writing by emphasizing geography, demography, materialism, and environment.
His framework identifies three timescales: the longue durée, slow-changing geography; conjunctures, medium-term systemic changes in demographics and economics; and l'histoire événementielle, transient surface events. This perspective raises profound questions about America's current geopolitical focus. Are wars in Iraq and Afghanistan mere transient flecks of surf, while more structural challenges develop closer to home? America's geographical position remains remarkably secure, with oceans to east and west and a stable, prosperous Canada to the north. Yet the southwest border with Mexico represents America's one true geographical vulnerability, the place where national and imperial boundaries exist in tension. Unlike the peaceful U.S.-Canadian frontier that has ceased to matter, the Mexican borderland is broad, indistinct, and marked by the largest income gap between any contiguous countries in the world, with American GDP 9 times that of Mexico. America's foreign policy emerges from its domestic condition, and nothing will shape that condition more than Latin history's northward movement. Mexico's 111 million people, plus Central America's 40 million, constitute half the U.S. population, with NAFTA binding 85% of Mexico's exports to America. While the U.S. median age approaches 37, Mexico's is 25 and Central America's even younger. Unlike Egypt with its geographical unity, Mexico is infernally divided by mountain ranges, the Sierra Madre Occidental, Sierra Madre Oriental, and others. So mountainous that if flattened it would equal Asia's size, Mexico includes the essentially separate Yucatan Peninsula and Baja California. This fragmentation provides context for northern Mexico's ongoing undeclared unification with the American Southwest. America's continental geography has been uniquely suited to nation-building. The Greater Mississippi Basin with the Intercoastal Waterway has more navigable river miles than the rest of the world combined, overlaying the world's largest contiguous piece of arable earth. The Atlantic coast possesses more major ports than the rest of the Western Hemisphere combined. These geographic advantages positioned America as a continental core destined for global leadership. While America's continental majesty framed by two oceans remains, another conceptual geography is emerging, one following Coronado's 1540-1542 south-to-north exploration rather than Lewis and Clark's east-to-west journey. This postmodern orientation provides a foundation for a future universal state stretching from semi-tropical Mexico to temperate North America. America's interaction with Mackinder's World Island will substantially depend on whether we develop into a cohesive, bilingual superstate with Mexico and Canada, or become trapped by a dysfunctional border region creating civilizational tension. We must be both a balancing power in Eurasia and a unifying power in North America, using stability guaranteed by balance to advance the liberal intellectual cause of a Middle Europa writ large across the globe. As Mackinder noted, a world balanced is a world free.